She packed my bags last night, brief flight, 0 hour, 9 a.m. And I'm gonna be high as a kite by then. I miss the earth so much, I miss my wife. It's lonely out in space on such a timeless flight. And I think it's gonna be a long, long time till touchdown brings me round again to find I'm not the man they think I am at home. Oh, no, no. I'm a rocket man. Rocket man, burning out this fuse up here alone. Mars ain't the kind of place to raise your kids. In fact, it's cold as hell, and there's no one there to raise them if you did. And all this science, I don't understand. It's just my job, 5 days a week. A rocket man, rocket man. And I think it's gonna be a long, long time till touchdown brings me round again to find I'm not the man they think I am at home. Oh, no, no. I'm a rocket man, rocket man. Burning out this fuse up here alone. And I think it's gonna be a long, long time. Well, folks, I have big news. We're moving to a new time. 8 to 10 p.m. on Thursdays and starting next week. And that's not all. We're switching from Studio B to Studio A. We're in the big time now. How about that? And we've been on Revolution Radio at freedomslips.com since December 2013. We were on Blog Talk Radio before that and Black Op Radio way back when we started in February 2011. We really appreciate the folks here at Revolution Radio, and we hope you do too, and we hope you'll head on over to freedomslips.com, buy some promo stuff, make a donation. Hey, maybe you can get a recording of all of our shows from last year. Yeah, something like that. Of course, you can listen to our archives on our website, newdream.us. But anyway, it's buy something from Freedom Slips because they're really great people. They put on a lot of great shows, and we're proud to be here. And we're proud to be moving over to the A stream. Yeah, not the A team. We don't jump out of planes, none of that stuff, but the A stream. Still pretty cool, I think. I'm Chuck Gregory. This is the New American Dream radio show, and I am proud now to introduce my friend and co-host, Mike Palachek, an American writer.
Hello, Chuck. Tonight we welcome special guests Thomas Wertman, Terry Ling, and Craig Lang. And so tonight we are joining together for the New American Dream radio show in Fort Lauderdale, Duluth, Newport Richey, Minneapolis, Cleveland, and wherever you are. Welcome to our UFO show. We welcome you to the UFO show. No single incident did more to put allegedly crashed saucers and little green men into the public consciousness than what took place in July of 1947, some 50 miles north of the New Mexico city of Roswell, when an unassuming farmer named Matt Brazell discovered a debris field strewn with tiny metallic strips and wooden sticks near his farm. More on that later. Well, we have never had guests on to talk about UFOs, not that I can remember, and it's about time. The underlying concept of the New American Dream radio show, which began with the New American Dream website back at the dawn of the Obama era, was that there are no wrong questions. If you have listened to the show before, you have heard our intro, the American Russian novel, All We Need Is More Vodka Radio Hour. And maybe you wonder what the hell that means. Well, to me, it means that we are living in a Russian novel, though we think this is America. We are characters inside a Russian novel in the time of the Soviet Union with Pravda, TASS, but we just don't know it yet, or maybe won't ever. But still, that is where we are. All we need is more vodka. The underlying concept of the New American Dream radio show is that the old American dream is pretty crappy and pretty stupid, to want a new house. And then you get it and wonder what all the fuss was about. We've gotten those, and it turns out it wasn't that great. Big house, bigger yard, five-piece toaster, and still you end up killing yourself buck naked some bright summer morning out in the zinnias with a glass of Chardonnay and your father's 45. If we really believe in this big concept, America, well, there's more. And it isn't to be found in stuff. It is to be found in knowledge, in the spiritual life, in high concept being good just because being good and loving each other and loving nature is the right thing to do, and that we're going to do that no matter what. That's what America is really about. We've come close to that high concept at times with Emma Goodman and with the Berrigan brothers, with national parks, with the Chicago Seven, with the Civil Rights Movement, with Bobby Kennedy. But since then, we have strayed a far ways from the path. And every single one of us knows, but will never, ever tell, that life in these United States would be so much less boring if the Thanksgiving adult big table conversation was not limited by social mores and cowardice to the Dallas Cowboys, good gas mileage, and dandelion spray. If we could open up that conversation to include who did 9/11, who killed Wellstone, who that is wearing that Obama mask behind that podium, to include Bigfoot and Sandy Hook, Boston, UFOs, then each year Uncle Bill would not feel so much like slipping away from the Thanksgiving table and going to the garage to smoke and hang himself with a chimney cleaning rope by jumping off Grandpa John's old olive green Chrysler. Who knows how many times Bill has been sent away to long sentences in Siberia by the roll of the eyes of the other adults at the Thanksgiving adult big table. Well, the New American Dream radio show is here because of Uncle Bill. It is he who we had in mind when we started this project in February of 2011. If there's one damn person in their apartment alone who understands this stuff we're talking about week after week, year after year, if there's one lonely person who discovers that she is not the only one, then it's all worth it. And so, of course, inevitably, inherently, we find our way to UFOs. To understand the overall concept of UFOs, go to on YouTube, Richard Dolan, UFOs and 9/11, understanding the two greatest conspiracy theories of our time. Or Richard Dolan, setting aside the truth value of the UFO phenomenon, it is an interesting sociological reality that so many people are unwilling to discuss the most and at times traumatic experience of their lives. What does it say about our society that this is so? My feeling is that by its very nature, it represents a form of repression. If you are someone who believes UFOs to be nonsense of some sort, I can nevertheless assure you that you have a friend or relation who has seen one. They simply have learned not to discuss it. Many people can live perfectly well within the constraints of repression and denial. They simply learn to shut off certain parts of their mind. It is sad that it happens all the time. But not everyone is the same. Not everyone is willing to do this or can even do it. By any estimate, there are many millions of people on this planet who have had a powerful UFO experience. They cannot and will not be silenced indefinitely. More Richard Dolan. People ask me, why do you think UFOs are relevant? There's 9/11, there's chemtrails, there's global financial fraud. Why would UFOs be so relevant? On the face of it, that sounds like a fair question, but when you actually get into the depth of it, the UFO cover-up is, I would argue, at the core of all the criminal illegality that we're actually dealing with. The UFO cover-up is a very key part of it. A few years ago, I did a night watch with a group of people who had very good quality night vision binoculars, several pairs of them. We passed them around. It was fascinating. Here's what I saw. Blew me away. You look up into the ordinary night sky, even on a clear night, and you'll see some aircraft. You'll see this and that, but you won't see a lot. You put these things on, and it literally seemed like Grand Central Station above my head. I was astonished. And these were not ordinary. They were very high altitude, very fast. And again, Richard Dolan. The moment of disclosure of UFOs is not the end of anything. It's the beginning of the real fight for truth. We saw demonstrations of a million people in Tahrir Square. Don't you think there might be a march of a million people on Area 51, Wright-Patterson Air Force Base, Los Alamos? Maybe. I'll bet you Wackenhut Security can stop a march of 100 people, but not a million. Not a million. And don't you think that just might happen? And what about opening up a new truth movement? Because after UFOs, then 9/11, JFK, underground bases, you name it, chemtrails, it's all going to be on the table. By God, what an exciting, challenging mess it's going to be. And so, in other words, the moment of disclosure is not going to be the end of anything. It's the beginning for the real fight for truth, not the end.
This portion of our program is being provided for you by the good folks at The Next Big Thing. New apps for your phone. More stuff for you to do while you're doing that boring driving thing. Well, folks, hold on to your hats because this new app is going to rock your world. It's the application that allows you to deal with the fact that some things you think are laughable are real. Download it today. Well, maybe tomorrow. We're working on it. We're getting dangerously close to the time when everyone will know that 9/11 was done by the U.S. government and the Israeli Mossad. We're not sure if you're ready for that, and that's why we're working overtime on new apps for you. The folks at The Next Big Thing ask you to be careful what you hope for. What happened today? Barack Obama and George W. Bush and his father are walked out of the golf course in handcuffs, charged with prior knowledge and hiding information about a felony, the attacks of 9/11. And a thoughtful U.S. Marshal puts his hand on George Sr.'s head so he does not bump it on the door. And we get the final public sneer of that career criminal. And it appears on the front page of the New York Post and Time Magazine and Rolling Stone. What happens when the talk about UFOs and Bigfoot and the Wellstone murder are about details and where and when and how, rather than a rolling of the eyes? What happens when we have actual names and court cases and confessions and Newsweek and Wall Street Journal and New York Times front page stories about the trial of some still living principals in the JFK, RFK, and Martin Luther King Jr. murders? Our whole world will be rocked. And somebody will need to make an app for that in a darn big hurry. But thanks to the folks at The Next Big Thing, it's all already in the works, guys. Things will be different. Our whole perception of life and what we should be doing in life will be changed forever. That might be scary, but it's where we need to go. Down the rabbit hole, folks. Step right up. Don't be shy. Okay, now, careful. One at a time. No pushing. Everybody will get their turn. Easy now, careful. There you go. We're the next big thing. And we bring your world to your vehicle, your doorstep, and right on up to your mind.
Over here, we need to talk about what? Are you kidding me? The Disclosure Project, of course. On Wednesday, May 9th, 2001, over 20 military, intelligence, government, corporate, and scientific witnesses came forward at the National Press Club in Washington, D.C. to establish the reality of UFOs or extraterrestrial vehicles, extraterrestrial life forms, and resulting advanced energy and propulsion technologies. The weight of this firsthand testimony, along with supporting government documentation and other evidence, established without any doubt the reality of these phenomena. Dr. Stephen Greer of the Disclosure Project. We can prove through testimony and documents that we will be presenting that this subject has been hidden from members of Congress and at least two administrations that we are aware of, two presidential administrations. There is a secret government, a covert government operation that has dealt with this for at least 50 years. People in Congress who make inquiries and President Clinton who made inquiries are simply denied access.
January 8, 2008, at least 200 people saw a UFO in the rural town of Stephenville, Texas, about 70 miles southwest of Fort Worth. The witnesses included a pilot, a lawman, and several businessmen. Reporter Angela K. Brown quotes one witness as describing the UFO, "the large silent object with bright lights flying low and fast." Another witness described seeing red glowing lights and then white flashing lights moving fast. Linda Soros reports seeing fighter jets chasing the UFO and describes the UFO as very large and without seams, nuts, or bolts. The Stephenville incident on January 8 saw dozens of witnesses reporting a large object in the evening sky that hovered above the community before it took off at high speed. Steve Allen, a pilot, observed the object from the ground and described it as being a half mile with flashing strobe lights. He also said it was pursued by two fighter jets when it disappeared at a speed he estimated to be 3,000 miles per hour. I don't know if it was a biblical experience or somebody from a different universe or whatever, but it was definitely not from around these parts, Allen said. Another witness was local law enforcement officer Leroy Gateman, who reported as a red glowing object suspended 3,000 feet in the air. It was so fast I couldn't track it with my binoculars, said Gateman. Rick Sorrell says he saw the object while deer hunting in the woods. You look at the trees and it was right there, he told ABC News. He estimated it to be the length of 3 or 4 football fields, so he could not be entirely sure due to his vantage point. Sorrell has later claimed that military helicopters have overflown his property at low altitude, and he's been getting strange phone calls. He also claims an unknown man came to his door and even once told him that, son, we have the same caliber weapons you have, but we have more of them, after Sorrell grabbed his rifle. You need to shut your mouth about what you saw. I'm trying to decide whether or not to open the door, Sorrell said to the Empire Tribune. Just standing there face to face, looking at each other, I'm thinking he's dressed for the elements and the dogs are raising such a ruckus he must know he's in danger of being caught. That's when I realized he wanted me to see him. The man then turned away and walked into the woods.
Our first guest of the evening is Thomas Wortman, a member of the Mutual UFO Network from Cleveland, Ohio. He is the state director and chief investigator. Chuck, I'll go ahead and read this, and when he gets online, I'll stop. MUFON officially began on May 31st, 1969. At that time, it was known as the Midwest UFO Network, as it outgrew the Midwestern state boundaries to become a world-class UFO organization. The name was changed to Mutual UFO Network. Hello?
Hello, Thomas. It's Chuck Gregory and Mike Palachek and the New American Dream Radio Show, and you are on the air.
Well, how are you both doing tonight? I hope you're doing great.
Well, we're doing great. I'm going to let Mike talk to you. I have to step away for just a second, and I know you guys will find a lot. I'm sorry I'm going to be missing this, but I've got to run out. I'll be right back, folks. Mike?
Thomas, this is Mike. How are you doing?
All right, I'm doing great.
Do you mind if I just ask you a few questions, or did you have something prepared that you want to go ahead with?
Well, no, go ahead and ask me a few questions on here, and we can go from there.
How did you get interested in the UFO issue?
Well, I actually started getting interested back in the whole UFO thing back in the 1960s from the first book I picked up on the subject, which was Flying Saucers, Serious Business by Frank Edwards. And then I kind of put things on the back burner until about, raising a family, career, everything else, until about 6 years ago when I got involved with MUFON, became a field investigator. And that time I've worked all my way self all the way up to a state director of Ohio.
Have you seen a UFO?
Actually, yes. Mine goes back, the first one, about 14 years ago. And I saw a triangular-shaped object about 300 feet across over an area called Peninsula, which is just south of Cleveland. But I've also gone through a number of regressions going back, because I believe that maybe a number of people in this field may be attracted to it because maybe we have a stronger connection or a connection going way back. And the regressions kind of showed that I had experiences back in the 1960s. And then things have gone on occasionally since then.
But by regressions, you mean hypnosis?
Yes, going back to hypnotic regression, because I've kind of gotten involved in this field almost like I tell people, you know, in the movie Close Encounters when Richard Dreyfuss started kind of like forming the potatoes into the mountain. When I started getting involved in the field, I felt like Richard Dreyfuss trying to, you know, find an answer. What am I seeing? Why am I so passionate about this subject? And it just kind of happened as a chance on it. I always thought about doing it, but one of my friends encouraged me to do it after he heard some of my stories, some of my memories going back to the 60s. And when we went through the regressions, the whole idea was to pursue those stories deeper and see if we could find a root of where a lot of stuff originated at. And some of the things that came out were, again, this is where that fine line between is it real, is it not, encounters with the Grays back in the 1960s.
And can you tell us any more about that, what you experienced in the 1960s?
Back in the 1960s, one of the experiences I had was a hunting expedition with one of my buddies. And we used to call it hunting, but really we killed a lot of Frigidaire refrigerators, Maytag washers. And we were hunting down in the South, in South Carolina. I was 13, he was 15. And on one of those expeditions we were going out, we had a spot in the woods where everything was complete calm, no noise, no anything else. And he was the one who started freaking out because he said, you know, hey, this isn't right. It's not supposed to be that quiet back here. And he told me stories about some creature called the Swamp Lily, which was kind of a Bigfoot-type creature back in that same area. And I kind of thought he was pulling one of those campfire stories on me. Well, the farther we walked, it kept getting quieter, and he started panicking. Even though we had a 12-gauge with magnums in it, he almost started running out of the woods. And along the way, I remembered looking up and seeing a disc-shaped object hovering above the treetops. Low, and I just kind of remember just walking and almost kind of half running, looking at it and just kind of looking disbelief at what I'm seeing. But for some reason, I just ignored it and just kept on going. At a point, he started talking about this large white owl that was in front of us that we saw. And I don't remember seeing anything like that. And he kept going over and over again. There's this huge white owl that we came across. It was right in front of us. I said, I don't see it. I don't remember it. And we got out of the woods eventually, and we had to walk, I don't know how many miles home. And he kept talking about the white owl. But when we did the regressions, we tried to go back to that same point. And it appeared to be some type of a block there. But what happened right around that time was not necessarily seeing the owl, but it was visions of being inside of a dome-shaped object, laying down flat on a table and having a gray, you know, just like about a foot and a half in front of my face, staring down at me. No emotions, just these eyes, which either just kind of looked at and you felt no emotion whatsoever when you looked at this entity. And we went back. We've done a couple of ones since then, too. And it kind of indicated the same thing, except over multiple times, that I had the earliest experience we could pretty much identify was back, not when I lived in South Carolina, but Ohio several years before that. In Ohio, as again, back in the woods, just kind of roaming around because my grandparents owned a farm. And something was pursuing me, came up behind me and started pursuing me through the woods. And I couldn't turn, I couldn't look at it. And it was almost like going back and forth beside me. If I tried to get out of the woods, it would, if I tried to go to my right, it would go to my right to make me go back to my left. If I started going to the left, it'd go to my left side, making me kind of go back to the right, almost basically hurting me in a certain direction. And no matter how much we tried to make me turn around, I couldn't do it. And all I could just hear was these feet just kind of shuffling through the woods. Eventually, I got out to a pond-type area. I don't remember seeing the entities at that point, but I had a discussion with my sister one time about that area. And she just said, you know, that pond, even though it was out in the middle of kind of a field down a little small valley, she said that pond area always scared her. Even though if you looked at a photograph of it, it was really nothing. But there was something about that region. And that's where we could pretty much identify some of the earliest experiences started from on there.
Don't you feel kind of lucky to have had these experiences?
Well, I think that's why maybe I've got such a strong connection back to this, because I have done some investigations where, you know, it almost seems like maybe something kind of rubbed off in the connection with them, because I did a investigation down in Puerto Rico. And when I was talking to the witness, she was describing the typical lights in the sky. The lights were following her mother down a smaller country road. But before she said another word, I started having images kind of scroll through my mind. And I saw this image of somebody sitting in a room at night, fairly large room, looking at windows on the other side of the room. And you could see kind of like ambient light coming in through the windows. And silhouetted in the ambient light in my mind, I was seeing an entity. I couldn't make out the shape, the exact face of it. All I could see is a silhouette. But I knew it was short in stature, lower than the window height for some reason. And I couldn't figure out why it was lower than the window height. But I was seeing this just as clear as day. And then she says, I want to tell you about some other experiences I had. And I said, what? She goes, well, I was sitting in my living room looking at the windows at night, and I saw an entity in front of the windows. And I'd seen that before she ever said a word. And we kept delving into the conversation even more. We went deeper with it on air. And I tried to find out more about, you know, the room setting, everything that's surrounding her. And she says at a certain point then, I said, you know, describe the living room, you know, how you kind of looked out, you know, how it appeared. She goes, well, if you come out where I was sitting at, you had to step down a couple steps and you went into another level of the same room. It was kind of like a sunken living room. And all of a sudden, it was right in my mind, that was why the entity was lower than a normal room height. The room was sunken. And I've had several occasions where I've interviewed witnesses that I've had visions of what they were going to describe before they ever talked about it. And it always made me wonder if there was some connection. And that's why I'm drawn to this field so passionate. I kind of call it like a moth being drawn to a flame, you know? And in my case, the flame are entities and UFOs.
Thomas, we're getting close to where the music is going to start playing. Could you let people know if you would like to do that? I don't know if you want to, but if you want people to contact you or to let you see what you have written or where to be in touch with you, how could they do that?
Well, I've written a number of short stories, but I'm going to start possibly writing a book about it this fall. And if they go to our website, which is MUFONOhio.com, it has links which they can in turn reach out and contact me on there. And that's one of the best ways. Our webmaster always passes information on right away, and I'm more than willing to talk to anybody about this because I think it's just a fascinating subject that I just want to keep pursuing even more.
Thomas, we're going to have you on again. I hope you'll agree to come back at another time. Thank you very much.
Oh, absolutely. Thank you.
You have a good night.
Bye. You too. Bye.
William Shatner. There is no doubt that there is life out there. The mathematics of it lead you to that absolute conclusion. In my mind, there is no doubt that the universe teems with life in all its forms. To my way of thinking, there is every bit as much evidence for the existence of UFOs as there is for the existence of God. Probably far more. At least in the case of UFOs, there have been countless taped and filmed and, by the way, unexplained sightings from all over the world, along with documented radar evidence seen by experienced military and civilian radar operators. George Carlin. The nations of the world will have to unite.
For the next war will be an interplanetary war. The nations of the Earth must someday make a common front against attack by people from other planets. General Douglas MacArthur. Bill Hicks. People are bringing shotguns to UFO sightings in Fife, Alabama. I asked the guy, why do you bring a gun to a UFO sighting? Guy said, well, we didn't want to be abducted. If I lived in Fife, Alabama, I'd be on my hands and knees every night praying for abduction.
If I become president, I'll make every piece of information this country has about UFO sightings available to the public and scientists. I am convinced that UFOs exist because I have seen one. President Jimmy Carter during his presidential campaign. Dan Aykroyd then went on to share the account of one of his drivers. He says the driver used to be a cook at the Air Force's Strategic Air Command. The driver says one day a bunch of guys were gathered around a radar screen watching an object that was traveling at 70,000 miles per hour and performing whip turns. I believe that there are probably many species coming and going and that the Air Force is very interested, but they can't come out and say, says Aykroyd, because then you're going to go, well, wait a minute, the parish priest, the cop on the street, the president, you don't have the power, they've got the power. If that were to happen, Aykroyd says, there may be a complete breakdown of society.
I believe that these extraterrestrial vehicles and their crews are visiting this planet from other planets. Most astronauts were reluctant to discuss UFOs. I did have occasion in 1951 to have 2 days of observation of many flights of them, different sizes, flying in fighter formation, generally from east to west over Europe. Major Gordon Cooper, NASA astronaut, to the United Nations.
Bill Hicks, I'll tell you, too, that's starting to depress me about UFOs, about the fact that they cross galaxies or wherever they come from to visit us and always end up in places like Fife, Alabama. Maybe these are not super intelligent beings, man. Maybe they're like hillbilly aliens, some intergalactic Joe family or something. Don't you all want to land in New York or L.A.? Nah, we just had a long trip. We're going to kick back and whittle some. Oh, my God, they're idiots. We're going to enter our mothership in the tractor pull. My God, we're being invaded by rednecks, my biggest fear. Last thing I want to see is a flying saucer up on blocks in front of some trailer, you know. Wouldn't that be depressing? Some bumper sticker on it. They'll get my ray gun when they pry my cold, dead, 18-fingered hand off of it.
And now, sponsored by Kibble's astronaut food, including Schlitz malt liquor in a plastic bag, fried chicken in a tube, 9 bean salad on a stick, and freeze-dried gummy bears. It's not bad, and if you don't eat it, you'll die. Another episode of The Dukes of Pluto. We find Carl and Dwayne from the planet Pluto, a small has-been, never-was planet in the middle of nowhere out cruising above southeast Wisconsin on a Saturday night. They've got ZZ Top turned up full blast.
They're chugging Michelob Golden Light and playing chicken with some F-16s from the 115th Air Fighter Wing. They get bored. They zoom down over a high school kegger in the woods and frighten everyone away, screaming, scrambling. They shine the zoom ray down and they spot over on a stump someone they know from back home. Old Yoda Bubba is sitting next to his crashed 69 Chevy Luna Lander with the mag wheels four on the floor and cassette deck. He's singing, I am a lineman for the county, and drinking Boone's Farm Strawberry Hill. Carl and Dwayne don't bother Bubba, just let him be. Carl and Dwayne just hover for a while, watching the high school kids scatter all around like ants who have just had their heel kicked over.
It's such a big universe, says Carl.
I know, right, says Dwayne.
The Milky Way is like so lame.
Tell me about it. Nothing ever happens here.
We gotta get away. We could be somebody if we just got out of here. We could be somebody.
What do you want to be? A fireman? An Indian chief?
I don't know. Maybe an astronaut.
Tune in next week for another episode of The Dukes of Pluto, sponsored by Kibble's Astronaut Food. It's not that bad. And if you don't eat it, you'll die. And now, with your host, Carl Sagan, another daytime special episode of Small Blue Dot Jeopardy. Tonight's categories, Richard Nixon, Jackie Gleason, and that glorious night at Homestead Air Force Base, Clinton, Bush, Obama, reptilians, or Anakin, famous government announcements about UFOs, tinfoil baking recipes, 50 Shades of Greys, the 6 sexy superheroes who saved Saturn, Area 51, Where's Waldo, astronauts gone wild, and why do UFOs only appear in trailer parks in the deep south, and Let's Talk Dirty in Romulan. We will return after a word from our sponsor, Blue Dot Toilet Bowl Cleaner.
Hello, this is Andy Rooney. Do you ever wonder about UFOs? I mean, people have seen them. They see them every day. You don't, not you, but people do. In crop circles, Don't you ever wonder? Other people see them all over the world, but you don't. Why does everyone else see crop circles and UFOs and ghosts and Aunt Ella at the foot of the bed, but you don't? Don't you ever wonder what the hell is wrong with you? You know that dogs can sense what a person is like. Are dogs and UFOs, ghosts and Aunt Ella avoiding you? Maybe you're giving off bad vibes. Maybe you're not showering regularly. Well then, this is Andy Rooney for Good Vibes Body Shampoo. If you're not seeing your fair share of UFOs, maybe you could use some good vibes. Hose down and lather up. Walk outside, stretch out your arms, and look up naked into the clear night sky with confidence. Good Vibes, the body shampoo for you. You'll have spaceships buzzing you like horseflies with good vibes. We guarantee it. Or your money back if you kept your receipt. Offer not yet available in Iowa.
Dr. Carol Rosen speaking at the National Press Club May 9th, 2001, along with other members of Project Disclosure. Dr. Carol Rosen. When I was a corporate manager of Fairchild Industries from 1974 through 1977, I met the late Dr. Werner von Braun. We first met in early 1974. At that time, von Braun was dying of cancer, but he assured me that he would live a few more years to tell me about the game that was being played, that game being the effort to weaponize space, to control the Earth from space and space itself. Von Braun had a history of working with weapons systems. He escaped from Germany to come to this country and became a vice president of Fairchild Industries when I had met him. Von Braun's purpose during the last years of his life, his dying years, was to educate the public and decision makers about why space-based weapons are dumb, dangerous, destabilizing, too costly, unnecessary, unworkable, and an undesirable idea, and about the alternatives that are available. As practically a deathbed speech, he educated me about those concepts and who were the players in the game. He gave me the responsibility, since he was dying, of continuing this effort to prevent the weaponization of outer space. When Werner von Braun was dying of cancer, he asked me to be a spokesperson, to appear on occasions when he was too ill to speak. I did this. What was most interesting to me was a repetitive sentence that he said to me over and over again during approximately 4 years that I had the opportunity to work with him. He said the strategy that was being used to educate the public and decision makers was to use scare tactics. That was how we identify an enemy. The strategy that Werner von Braun taught me was that first the Russians are going to be considered to be the enemy. In fact, in 1974, they were the enemy, the identified enemy. We were told that they had killer satellites. We were told that they were going to get us and control us, that they were commies. Then terrorists would be identified, and that was soon to follow. We heard a lot about terrorism. Then we were going to identify third world country crazies. We now call them nations of concern. But he said that would be the third enemy against whom we would build space-based weapons. The next enemy was asteroids. Now, at this point, he kind of chuckled the first time he said it. Asteroids. Against asteroids, we are going to build space-based weapons. And the funniest one of all was that what he called aliens, extraterrestrials. That would be the final scare. And over and over and over during the 4 years that I knew him and was giving speeches for him, he would bring up that last card. And remember, Carol, he said, the last card is the alien card. We are going to have to build space-based weapons against aliens. And all of it is a lie.
And now, we return to Carl Sagan and Blue Dot Jeopardy. Our first contestant, Neil, from Neptune, Georgia.
I'll take all I ever learned on Mars was all I ever needed to know for 500. Our second guest of the evening is Terry Ling. Terry Ling is another member of MUFON. Terry is the Assistant State Director of MUFON, and she is in Newport Richey, Florida. We are a few minutes early, but I hope that Terry will be ready for us. Chuck will be getting Terry on the line right about now. All of our guests tonight are from MUFON. Thomas Wett, who is from Ohio, Terry from Florida, and we'll be talking to Craig Lang from Minnesota later.
Hello.
Hello, Terry. This is Chuck Gregory and Mike Palachuk and the New American Dream Radio Show, and you're on the air.
Well, that's great. Hi, guys, and thanks so much for having me, Mike and Chuck. I'm really honored to be a part of this. just wanted to say I am Terry Lang, for those who are tuned in. I'm the Assistant State Director for Florida MUFON. We are actually the Mutual UFO Network here in Florida. And I'm also a co-founder of Enigmatic Anomalies, which is EA Radio and EA TV. But I'm sure that what you guys want to know about tonight is how I got involved with UFOs and extraterrestrials. Well, it all started in 1979 for me when I was about 27 years old. I was on my way home from work, and I had a very interesting introduction to a UFO and an alien. Actually, they had sought me out, and that's how they do things. They seem to choose people that they're going to reveal to. And they did seek me out that night on a street in St. Pete, Florida. It was 28th Street North. And it was my first and only at the time eye-opening experience, actually, with UFOs and extraterrestrials. And I got to tell you, I've never been the same since, because once you see something like that, you are immediately kind of in a place where you've got to deal with it. You don't just walk away from that and say, oh, yeah, okay. I mean, you have to say to yourself, how do I wrap my mind around that? You know, so it's really a profound experience that is life-changing. And you know, for skeptics out there, I don't blame you for being skeptical. I would have never believed this had it not happened to me. So all I can say is that until it happens to you, you probably would remain skeptical. But anyway, I was a true unbeliever at that time in all things UFO. And I didn't believe in any of it. I really believed it was all comic book entertainment, and it changed me profoundly. I became an instant believer once I beheld what I saw. And what I saw that night was an amazing, almost looked like a liquid, biological type of silver disc, which hovered over the railroad tracks at the railroad crossing right on 28th Street North in St. Pete, which was very near my home, just a few blocks away. What happened was there was a tall white extraterrestrial that was standing to my right near another disc that had landed in a grassy area, just a little bit right of the railroad track. And it was engulfed in a huge blue-white light. And I ended up on that craft somehow. I'm not really sure how that all happened. We can talk about that a little later. But I did end up on the craft, and it was missing time that I actually experienced. And I didn't know about missing time. I thought I had only been there about 20 minutes, but my experience actually lasted about 2 hours. And, you know, you don't know you're having missing time if you don't know that there is such a thing as missing time. So I was really unaware of that. And I only found this out through a recent regression that I did in 2012, which was actually some 30 years after my experience, you know. And, you know, I might just add, too, that that's not something I ever talked about, because I didn't, like so many, I didn't want to be ridiculed or made fun of. And, you know, I need to address that if I could right now. People have to stop doing that. If somebody has a life-changing experience, you don't make fun of them. If somebody gets in a car accident and becomes crippled or paraplegic, you don't make fun of them. That's life-changing for them. When you see a UFO and, you know, you don't believe in it and you're a victim of this and they've chosen to, you know, reveal to you, people shouldn't be making fun of you for that, you know. I think people that don't believe it, keep that to yourself, you know, because there's probably a lot of things you don't believe that might happen to you one day. I hear people say that all the time. Oh, that'll never happen, until it does. But anyway, my story and what happened to me that night in 1979 is very in-depth, and it takes more time to share than we've really got allotted here tonight. But one thing I did want to say about it all is what bothered me the most about that experience truly was the human factor. And, you know, our government hides all things UFO and ET from the public. They always have, and they always will. I should say maybe not always. Maybe they're getting closer to revealing. I'm hoping that that's going to happen. But anyway, no wonder I was shocked at what happened to me the night that it all happened. Because, you know, it's not in the newspaper. It wasn't really on TV. We might have had a thing or two here or there, but I mean, it really wasn't covered that much. So I didn't believe in it. And nobody I hung around with or lived with or anything that I knew of at the time believed in it. I found out a lot of things later. But so many people have experienced UFOs at this point, and I can tell you that for a fact, being the assistant state director for Florida MUFON, that it seems that the extraterrestrials are disclosing one-on-one. And that also seems to be a part of their plan. After all these years, people are just simply waking up to the whole truth about what's really going on in our skies. And I might also add, Florida is incredibly busy. And, you know, this is my domain here in Florida. And we have hundreds of reports. I will say that only 5% of our reports are going to actually be UFO related. The others are going to be, could be hallucinations. It could be planets or stars. It could be airplanes or misidentified things. But as a whole, only 5% of those are going to be real. And when they're real, it's amazing. So anyway, the reason I'm involved also in enigmatic anomalies, I did mention that earlier, is because along with the alien agenda, there does seem to be a huge portion that is paranormal, that happens around almost everybody that has experiences. So at this point, we're looking at it and wondering, do they really go hand in hand? Because it does appear that way. And I've experienced paranormal, spiritual, extraterrestrial, and what I label as demonic, because there's been so many odd things, really strange things that have happened to me in my lifetime. And if you want to read about any of that, you can go to www.terryling.com. I've started to write a lot of this stuff down just so that I don't forget about it because, you know, when you've had 100 and something different experiences, they all do seem to pretty much get clumped together, if you will. But anyway, I do have plenty of experiences there that you can read. And I call it a paranormal life shared because enigmatic anomalies covers just about everything that is enigmatic and anomalous, actually. And we've got a site also I like to mention, www.ea-radio.org. And on there are all the different Spreaker interviews that I've done on EA Radio with all of these different varied paranormal people and ufologists, just for those who might be curious and might want to know a little bit more about what's going on. It's there for you. And I'm trying to educate the public as much as I can. You know, I really think that we need that education desperately. And I also want to say that I'm very aware of the alien government agenda that's happening even right now. In Dulce, New Mexico, that's one of the underground facilities that actually houses, and this is common knowledge amongst ufologists, different alien species, extraterrestrials that work right alongside our black ops and above top secret military agendas. There's many people over the years that I've spoken to. Paul Hellyer is someone who is a Canadian, and he has come out with a book recently, Aliens Are as Real as Airplanes. And, you know, he's quoted as saying many things about them being real. And he was, it eludes me at the moment what his actual title is, defense minister with Canada is what I'm thinking, but I know he's got other titles. But, you know, Canada is disclosing and they're talking about it, but it seems like America just doesn't want to jump on that bandwagon for whatever reason. But there are areas called S4, and of course everybody's heard about the infamous Area 51. Those aren't all very real. You know, why do you think they have people that'll shoot you if you walk on those facilities? You know, I mean, there's got to be a reason for that stuff, right? So if you visit enigmaticanomalies.com, you can see a lot of the involvement that I've had with Enigmatic Anomalies over the years and different ufologists that I've spoken to. And, you know, just my thoughts and other people's thoughts about what is going on. I do think that aliens are walking amongst us. I really do. I know that's something that we had talked about earlier, and I did want to address that. Many people believe that we interact with them and are completely unaware of it. I have never seen anyone other than the extraterrestrials that I have personally seen, but that doesn't mean that they're not out there. I'm not saying that other people haven't, but I personally have never known anybody in my presence that I suspected to be extraterrestrial. But I have heard that they are here and they are among us, and I've heard it from some pretty trustworthy people. And, you know, I think what is kind of looming out on the horizon for us all in the future is that there will be disclosure. NASA is actually talking about the year 2025. They will actually come forth. One of their chief scientists have stated that they will bring forth the truth about what's going on with aliens. And they know so much more than, you know, than what they're saying at this point. So, well, thank you for all listening. I hope you'll visit me at www.terryling.com. Thanks for having me, guys. I've had a great time.
Thank you, Terry. And hope to talk to you again sometime. Phil Ferrugio posts on World News Trust, Information Clearinghouse, and many others. He resides in Port Orange, Florida, and here he is with It's the Empire, Stupid.
Good evening, Working Stiffs. You know, in 1935, author Sinclair Lewis wrote, "When fascism comes to America, it will be wrapped in the flag and carrying the cross." Amazing how we could see ahead 80 years. With another July 4th just finished, replete with the usual fireworks, barbecues, and beer, perhaps it's time for us to ponder the direction our American empire has taken. Let's just focus on the 15 years of this, the 21st century, okay? The presidential election of 2000 revealed, blatantly to the world outside of our borders, just how devious this military-industrial empire can be. The movers and shakers of our two-party, one-party syndicate, and that is what they really are, decided that it would be much better if, for their greedy and exploitative interests, to have Junior Bush and his puppeteer, Darth Cheney, in office. Al Gore would have been okay to them, having done his apprenticeship under their stooge, Smirking Bill, but maybe the Bush-Cheney gang could get more done and quicker. So they fixed the election and got that gang in the power they needed to do their dirty deeds. And boy, they sure did. The folks in the 9/11 Truth Movement love the flag and are as patriotic, more so in fact, than those who follow the empire's company line. One fine attribute of that group is that it's made up of conservatives, ultra-conservative, libertarians, progressives, socialists, etc. All they focus on is what really happened on 9/11 and, of course, afterwards, when the police surveillance state went wild. To love one's country and its flag is not exclusive to the right-wing or neoliberal crew. It is not exclusive to the phony hypocrites within the Republican and Democratic parties they who serve the empire so well. We who care about this great nation follow the words of Ben Franklin to a T. Dissent is the lifeblood of democracy. Thus we stood, and many still stand, out in public against the warmongers within this empire who destroyed Afghanistan, Iraq, and Libya, and now wish to do the same with Syria and maybe Russia. Now, that would be too dangerous. Russia has the nukes, and you don't want to screw around with that. Now we come to the great standard bearer, old-time religion. You cannot believe how many Muslims I've spoken to who think that the zealots and fanatical Islamists do not have a clue as to what the Quran teaches. They have nothing in common with people who preach killing infidels and establishing Islamic states, etc. Jewish folks I speak to feel the same about the arrogant, fanatical Zionists, people who think that non-Jews are second class and not worthy of the same rights that Jews enjoy in Israel, especially Arabs. Sadly, they look upon the Palestinians as the Nazis did to their ancestors, subhuman body feeders. Of course, the cream de la cream of fanatical religious thinking has to be reserved for my good old Christian warriors who see the planet as a battleground for their good versus everyone else's evil. How many moments in actual New Testament scripture does one need to read about what Jesus of Nazareth preached? Easier for a camel to go through the eye of a needle than a rich man enter the kingdom of God. When a wealthy young man asked to follow him, Jesus said, "If you want to be perfect, go sell what you have and give to the poor, and you'll have treasure in heaven, and come follow me." As far as preemptive wars and drone missile attacks, whereupon collateral damage becomes a way of life, Jesus actually said, "Inasmuch as ye have done it unto one of the least of these, my brothers, you have done it unto me." This writer realizes it is not cogent in the realm of political discourse and dissent to share one's belief in the Almighty or in the faith of a universe outside of this crap we call reality. A very wise man once told me when I asked him, "Is there a God?" that the universe or God is simply love. Thus, logic would dictate that if one believes that, then what follows is anything not of love cannot be of God. Jackie DeShannon put it best in the Burt Bacharach and David 1960s song, "What the world needs now is love, sweet love. It's the only thing there is much too little of. What the world needs now is love, sweet love. No, not just for some, but for everyone. Waving flags and wearing religious icons while saluting war and empire is not going to do it, folks. Thank you."
I'm mad as hell, and I'm not going to take it anymore. Hello, everyone. Now for your local Earth news. This is Chuck Gregory and Mike Polachek with a review of today's news from the eye of the hurricane and the eye of the blizzard. Some recent UFO sightings from the MUFON Last 20 Sightings Report, to be found at MUFONCMS.com. July 30th, Jacksonville, Florida.
I was coming back from the gas station. When I got back home, I decided to just stand outside for a bit and look at the stars. Recently, I noticed that the more I pay attention to the sky and what's in it, the more things appear in the sky. This was the first time ever seen something so clear in my life. As I was looking up, bright flash of blue-green white light streaked through the sky about 3 seconds and vanished like it was never there. I began crying because in my mind, I was asking myself, is there anyone out there? Or am I wasting my time? Then there it was, right where I was looking in the sky. I wanted to stay outside longer, see what else I could witness, but I was overcome by fear just from hearing about abductions and people and children being taken by strange lights. So I decided to go inside. When I came back outside about 2 minutes later, I tried to look for something else, and lo and behold, I witnessed what looked like a star just making its way across the sky. No bigger, but no smaller than the stars surrounding it. I watched this for about 1 minute, then the feeling of fear of being watched took hold of me again. I began crying again, but it wasn't tears from only fear, but also happiness. And there's no way that is anything from this planet or dimension.
July 29th, Milwaukee, Wisconsin.
I was at the park with my stepdad and neighbors when my stepdad noticed an object in the sky. It looked like a fireball to me, so it broke into more objects and hovered and moved independent of one another, and they didn't continue to free fall like the original object. Curious to what it could be, surprised it was happening right in front of me. My reaction after the fact was, that's the type of event you only hear about or see on TV. I lost sight of it, because it disappeared.
And a sighting report from July 24th, Santa Margarita, California.
An event held on May 25 at the Santa Margarita featured a B-25 Mitchell bomber, which offered rides to the public from the private strip on the ranch. While working in my front yard, I saw the B-25 flying just above the oak tree, heading north before making a turn towards the south and proceeding onto the runway for landing. As the plane passed me, I took my Samsung Galaxy phone and began taking a few pictures. As I did, I saw something streak past the plane heading west as the plane headed north. I quickly lost sight of the object. My attention was focused on the plane. When I looked at my pictures, I saw the object was captured in one of the photos. I cannot identify the object. I'm forwarding this report to you for your file.
From the MUFON Last 20 Sightings Report, this report, July 30th, Stormville, New York.
Shy of a full moon tonight, but a bright, beautiful night. I was observing a plane flying over an East Fishkill location of New York around 10:30 p.m. I stood on the back deck and looked up at the few stars. I noticed a faint, round, oval, dull object in the far east sky moving from south to north, facing east. As it moved, I seen it disappear. I thought, okay, maybe a drone, but it was so high up in the sky. I moved towards my porch to look up to the stars again. At 10:40 p.m., I noticed the same dull, star-like, round, oval object on the other side moving in a northerly direction. It hovered, then moved again. It eventually disappeared upon my observation. I've noticed these occasionally, but like my aunt in Puerto Rico says, it's just one of those wondrous things. It's part of our universe.
And July 25th in Evanston, Wyoming.
Eight orange orbs seen flying in single file formation about 500 feet up. One orange orb caught my eye out of my living room window where I sit with the couch under the window. Looking southeast, about 1 mile away from me, a bright orange orb was coming towards me in a right-to-left direction. If I was at 6 o'clock, the orbs were flying from 2 to 7 o'clock. Then I saw another orange orb, approximately 100 yards beyond the first one. Then another appeared, and then another. Looking back at orb number one, it was now closer, maybe a half a mile away. These orange orbs were solid in nature, no blinking, flashing, or dimming. At any one time, my son and I saw four or five lights all in a row, stringing from left to right, with the left light being the closest, far right being the farthest away. It was already sundown, as this occurred just after dusk. And now the weird part. All four or five of these orbs were moving slowly and smoothly. Then the first orb light faded out, then orb number five appeared, then number two faded out, number six orb appeared, and so on, and so all eight orbs eventually appeared and faded out just before hitting the town limit. These orbs did not change direction ever, so it's not like the first orb turned. That's why I couldn't see the light. Again, at any one time, we saw four or five of the orbs, all bright, deep orange. We walked out front and watched. It was dead silent. No sound at all. We should have heard sound from that distance. All orbs flew at the same altitude, I'd say about 500 foot up. No trail, smoke, or fire around the orbs, just pure orange light. Missed out on getting a camera.
Yeah, that's all, folks. That's news, and we are out of here. Good night and good luck, and so it goes. That's the way it is. Stay on the same page. Take it to the next level. It is what it is. At the end of the day, have a good day, and always remember to tip your congressman. The third guest of the evening is Craig Lang, L-A-N-G, a member of MUFON from Minneapolis, Minnesota. Craig Lang is the MUFON state director, and Chuck will be getting Craig on the line right about now.
How you doing?
Hello, Craig. This is Chuck Gregory and Mike Palachek and the New American Dream Radio Show, and you're on the air.
Sounds good. Good to be here.
Well, we're glad to have you. Can you tell us a little bit about yourself and MUFON?
Okay, well, basically, MUFON, Minnesota MUFON, we have about 15 field investigators here, and I'm the state director of it, and we have a, we're right in the middle of quite a few, several really significant cases here, and several abduction cases and several cases. One of them, we thought we had some physical evidence that turns out, I think, that probably it turns out to probably be a false alarm. But it really gave us a pause for to look at some of the interesting things that can happen when you get some really extraordinary cases. And then, in addition, I am a part of the experiencer research team, and I'm a hypnotherapist. I do a lot of work with close encounter experiencers, and that's been quite an adventure too. So, anyway, that's me in a nutshell. I've been a hypnotherapist, been in practice since 1998, and so been pretty involved in close encounter work for all that time.
Well, can you tell us some more specifics about one or two of the cases that you've been involved with?
Well, we've worked several major close encounter cases in the last few months. We've had a cases where several experiencers were, you know, abducted at the same time, like a husband and wife, or one other case, a couple of siblings were remembered experiences as children. So we're in the middle of investigating a number of those. And in addition, it's been a very busy sky up there. So a lot of light in the sky cases, quite a few of them which are unexplained. And so it's just been very busy, you know, kind of in a generic sense in a lot of ways.
Are most of these in Minnesota? They're relatively local to you?
Most of these are in Minnesota, yeah.
Is there a specific area where they happen, or is it pretty much all over?
Kind of spread out all over the state. They tend to be in proportion to the population just because there's more people to see them, but they generally tend to be spread out over the state, yeah.
It's interesting you say they're proportional to the population. I would have thought that there wouldn't be as many near population centers.
Actually, you'd be surprised at the number of sightings that seem to occur right within the metro area. I think some of them are explainable or a fair number of them are explainable as kind of Venus is pretty high in the sky right now, and we're right on the aircraft flight lines and things like that. So we get a lot of what we call IFO reports. But at the same time, we've had some very distinct unexplained that have occurred in the last little while. A couple of abduction cases and things like that I think are very significant unexplained.
Can you describe for us the steps that you follow to prove or disprove one of these, or just to investigate it in general?
Okay, well, the investigation process
is pretty straightforward. We one usually it begins with a report to MUFON, usually through the UFO reporting site on MUFON.com, and that comes to us then through the case management system. And that opens up an investigation. Either myself or the chief investigator, Bill McNeff, will assign the sighting case to one of the investigators. And let's say we've got about 14, about 10 of them are pretty active right now, investigators throughout the state. So we get quite a few. So then that opens up the investigation. And then the investigator pretty much immediately contacts the witness and arranges an interview. And if there's any other aspects of it that could be corroborated, say like with police reports, or usually the weather and some other, if there's like FAA radar traces or anything like that, any kind of photographic materials or any kind of physical evidence, lots of different things that could be gathered up and added to the investigation report. So then basically the investigator will go out and interview the witness. If there's more than one, and go out and interview both or all of them as much as possible, and gather any additional background material. And that's basically the core of the investigation. Excuse me. And then write up a report, which then goes into the MUFON reporting system and as the investigation report behind the sighting. So it tends to be a pretty pretty rigorous system now. We're really getting that in place now. So we've got a pretty rigorous system in place.
Do you find that there is obstruction by the government, or government cover up, or trying to cover things up?
Personally, I've never experienced that. Several people that I know of, mostly experiencers, have described that they've had issues with that. But personally, I have not seen it. One woman, who was described in my book, has had her room, her office rifled, and several of the folders containing correspondence between her and myself were stolen. And that's the only thing that the burglar took, was they went to her file drawer and pulled out that material and stole it. But that's the only time I've ever noted that we've had any kind of government issues. And then one recent experiencer case where, again, he had men in black confront him, and he had a lot of harassment, a lot of it was administrative. They froze his bank account and he lost his job and several things like that, that just directly traceable back to external interference from somebody. We don't really know who.
Have you personally seen a UFO?
I've seen a couple of little kind of lights in the sky, I would say. One orange orb that we were watching during a sky watch. I saw it fly over and change directions in a way that I would definitely describe as non-ballistic, non-aerodynamic. But I've never seen anything up close and personal that I know of, and that I can remember anyway.
So you haven't, say, seen an alien?
Not to my memory. I've done so much work with close encounter experiencers, and I've done a lot of deep trance work with them. So it's almost as if I've seen them myself, because I tend to get kind of a deep hypnotic rapport with clients when I'm working with them. So in a lot of ways, I can kind of vicariously see what they're seeing. So after a few hundred of those, you can pretty much
picture what a close encounter would be like. And so I, in that sense, I can almost picture myself having been in one. But at the same time, I have no reason to think that I actually have.
Hmm. Are they here? Are they walking around right among us?
Apparently, there are reports of that. Yes, that's entirely possible that that might be the case. We've had several cases, several experiencers describe where people, kind of an, I'll call them anomalous people, have confronted them, or they've encountered them just in daily life. They've encountered them in one situation or another. One lady that I was working with at one point described how she was standing in the line at a convenience store, and a couple standing behind her all of a sudden started speaking to her telepathically, and they knew all about her and about the encounter she had just had and things like that. So these people were definitely not your garden variety, ordinary people off the street, and several other cases like that too, where just kind of very almost normal looking people, but with some very extraordinary details in their lives, I would say.
Great. Thank you for joining us tonight. I knew we were just about out of time. I hope that talk to you again sometime.
Thank you.
The story of Betty and Barney Hill begins in September 1961 in the state of New Hampshire. Barney had recently developed an ulcer, and he and his wife Betty decided to take a short vacation to Canada. The couple had visited Niagara Falls and Montreal, and on the 19th of the month, they began their journey back home to Portsmouth. The night was clear with the crescent moon shining on the heavily wooded landscape that surrounded U.S. Route 3 in the central part of New Hampshire. At about a quarter past 10 p.m., 3 miles south of the city of Lancaster, Barney noticed what appeared to be a bright star or planet, which seemed to move erratically. Barney pointed this out to Betty, and they both began to keep track of the object. The couple began to believe that they were watching a plane appear and disappear as the movement of their vehicle caused the trees to come and go and obstructing their view. Later, Barney would state that he tried to convince himself that the object was a plane, but that Betty thought it to be something else, an unidentified craft of some kind. As the two continued to the flume just north of North Woodstock, the object appeared to move in an odd way. As they reached Indian Head, Barney actually stopped the car to have a look at the object with his binoculars. He saw multicolored lights and rows of windows on a flat-shaped object, which now seemed to be moving toward him. As the object moved within 100 feet of him, he could see occupants inside. Frightened, he ran back to his car where Betty waited. They climbed inside and sped away. Soon, 2 hours of their lives would vanish into oblivion. After resuming their journey home, they were not able to see the strange craft anymore. Oddly, though, they heard a beeping sound. They then heard the beeping a second time, noticing that they were suddenly 35 miles farther down the road than a minute or two ago. They were now in Ashla. The mood in the car was quiet as they proceeded home and went to bed. They both slept until the next afternoon. When Betty got up, she called her sister Janet and told her what had happened. Janet told her to call nearby Peace Air Force Base and report what she had seen. Betty reported the incident, speaking to Major Paul W. Henderson, who told Betty, "The UFO was also confirmed by our radar. It is important to note at this point that Barney was against calling the sighting into the base, hoping to keep it quiet." At this time, neither Betty nor Barney recalled any abduction. Soon, however, Betty began having nightmarish dreams of her and her husband being taken aboard a craft of some kind against their will. In a matter of weeks, 2 writers got wind of the story, and after interviewing the Hills, made an intensive log of the events of the night. They discovered that there were 2 hours of unaccounted time in the Hills story, even allowing for stops for the Hills and breaks for their dog, who also made the trip with them. Sometime during the first week of July 1947, a local New Mexico rancher, Mac Brazil, while riding out in the morning to check his sheep after a night of intense thunderstorms, discovered a considerable amount of unusual debris. It had created a shallow gouge several hundred feet long and was scattered over a large area. Some of the debris had strange physical properties. After taking a few pieces to show his neighbors, Floyd and Loretta Proctor, Brazil drove into Roswell and contacted the sheriff, George Wilcox. Sheriff Wilcox notified authorities at Roswell Army Airfield and, with the assistance of his deputies, proceeded to investigate the matter. Shortly after becoming involved, the military closed off the area for a number of days and retrieved the wreckage. It was initially taken to Roswell Army Airfield and eventually flown by B-29 and C-54 aircraft to Wright Field in Dayton, Ohio. Roswell Army Airfield was the home of the 509th Bomb Group, which was an elite outfit, the only atomic group in the world. On the morning of July 8, 1947, Colonel William Blanchard, commander of the 509th Bomb Group, issued a press release stating that the wreckage of a crashed disc UFO had been recovered. The press release was transmitted over the wire services in time to make headlines in over 30 U.S. afternoon newspapers that same day. Within hours, a second press release was issued from the office of General Roger Ramey, commander of the 8th Air Force Base, Air Force at Fort Worth Army Airfield in Texas, 400 miles from the crash site. It rescinded the first press release and, in effect, claimed that Colonel Blanchard and the officers of the 509th Bomb Group at Roswell made it unbelievably foolish mistake and somehow incorrectly identified a weather balloon and its radar reflector as the wreckage of a crashed disc. One of those two press releases had to be untrue. There is now solid testimony from numerous credible military and civilian witnesses who were directly involved that the crashed disc press release issued by Colonel William Blanchard of the 509th Bomb Group from Roswell was true, and the subsequent weather balloon press release from 8th Air Force Headquarters in Fort Worth, Texas, was a hastily contrived cover story. Those who knew and worked with William Blanchard says he was a solid, no-nonsense, businesslike individual and not someone who would make a fool of himself and the Air Force by ordering a press release about something as out of the ordinary and dramatic as the event at Roswell without being certain he was correct. In other words, if Blanchard issued a press release saying that there was a crashed disc, there was a crash disc. Colonel William Blanchard would later go on to become a four-star general and vice chief of staff of the United States Air Force. The first witness located by investigators who was willing to testify and allow his name to be used was retired Lieutenant Colonel Jesse Marcel, the intelligence officer of the 509th Bomb Group at Roswell. He was a highly competent individual and one of the first two military officers at the actual crash site. In a 1979 videotape interview, Jesse Marcel stated, "It was not a weather balloon, nor was it an airplane or a missile." As to the exotic properties of some of the material, he stated, "It would not burn. That stuff weighs nothing. It's so thin, it isn't any thicker than the tin foil in a pack of cigarettes. So I tried to bend the stuff. It wouldn't bend. We even tried making a dent in it with a 16-pound sledgehammer, and there was still no dent in it."
Well, it's been another long week in Mount Liberty, Nebraska, my hometown, at the end of the empire. Yankers go long! Rick falls into the back seat. AC reaches toward the radio. Oh, wait! Rick puts a hand up and pitches an ear to hear if the big red could pull it out with a Hail Mary. Van Brownson drops back, says the announcer. He moves left in the pocket. The ball is up! It's incomplete. Okay, go ahead, he says, waving his hand. Damn. AC cuts off the mournful announcers in Lincoln. Dreamweaver buzzes in the dashboard. KSTP, Oklahoma City. Nothing around here except country and polka. AC tunes it a little. Fly me high through the starry skies, maybe to an astral plane. Still, it buzzes. Too early. Got to be dark at least. Best after midnight. Rick sticks his face even farther into mine. Ooh, clear as hell. Look at that, I say, looking out my window, seeking a new smell. I downshift and look. Out in the stubble, a hawk stares at us, daring us to fight like the boys from Stanton. Under one foot, a rabbit struggles with wide eyes. It stops and asks us for help. Stop. Stop. Rick puts a hand on my shoulder and one on the shotgun on the floor. I shrug hard to get his hand off. I break and then go. Effing corner. His brother drowned yesterday. And he's out road hunting and drinking. Tom Corner was out swimming at the new lake. Brand new lake they made. He was swimming around out toward the middle. Guess he dived down in some seaweed stuff, grabbed his ankle, and he couldn't get back up. Makes sense to me. I can see how it would happen. Whole town was out there watching the fire department in this rowboat. I guess the fire department rowboat. The gas Tom in the thigh yanked him up into the boat with the coffee thermoses and extra rope. Blood spreading across the lake. Rick was there, standing right there with me and AC and most of the other guys. Kenny, says AT. PTTPRO. Power to the people, right on. He hands me a fresh can of Schlitz. Like some Zen bartender who just knew I needed one. He rolled down his window to toss two cans at a fence post, left-handed. First can hits the top of AC's window, spraying just all over the inside of my 57 Chevy. I swear, holler on. Says AC. He apologizes. We dab with hunting jackets, gloves, stocking caps. He finally nails a fence post. He played baseball up through Babe Ruth League. I slide up to second, arranging my hands to steer and drink. Put my arm in my window and enjoy. Black and white. Bench seats. Radio works great. All the metal, thick, hard quality. No rust. Everything original except the tape deck. Tires. Gas. A classic. I know it. I knew it the minute I climbed in after my dad brought it home for me. He found it by peeking in some old lady's locked garage. Tore the mud flaps off and those metal reflectors by the front window. What are those for? Every shift, song, or corner turned is a joy in this car. What's great is that I understand it. Maybe my dad made me understand, but I think I came up with understanding on my own. The mark a great teacher leaves is no mark at all. They don't make cars like that now. Ever hear anyone mooning over their old Lumina or Tercel or Accord? Guys have dreams about these old Chevys. I wish they had the sense back then to appreciate, same as their first girlfriends. The Schlitz is not cold, maybe cool if you squeeze. AC's got sore knees because he's got the cooler on his side. Rick's got the guns. We're all wearing red or blue flannel and Clarasil. The brown canvas hunting jackets are now everywhere. It's hot. Well, not really. It was hot. We walked one field, then we were thirsty, and we started drinking. We were going to wait till it got really cold, almost too cold to touch the cans, but we didn't. We got up before dawn on a Saturday to go hunting. We put on coffee, even if we don't drink coffee. Maybe we're hungover. We put on all these clothes, these big hunting boots when tennis shoes would probably be okay. And then the guns come up from the basement or out on the porch. Gives the whole thing gravitas. Well, it does. And I think our dads think now we're getting down to something serious and we might amount to something. I don't know why they would think that. For the past few hours, we've just been driving around. We see a bird and we almost stop and jump out to shoot. For the past hour, it's just been Rick shooting out the back window. There aren't many pheasants or me and AC be dead by now from having our eardrum blown out. Big hole in our head from that. Rick also shoots at squirrels, crows, stop signs. Poor guy, he just wants to kill something so bad you can't blame him, but I'm sick of that gun going off in the car. My dad would fucking kill me. It's so loud. I speed up whenever there's anything running around. It's like it went off right by your ear. It's loud. I turn left to go to Broken Bridge. And now it was almost dark. That's how I remember it. It's a gravel road with most of the gravel pushed off toward the sides and a long hump, so you have to stay toward the middle. Kind of a narrow road anyway. Broken Bridge is one of the places we would go swimming. There's a beach, sort of. In some places, the water, it's called Spring Branch Creek, or maybe North Fork. The water's deep in some places if you kneel down to piss. It's mostly a place where you can ask some girls if they want to go out to Broken Bridge or something. Party at Broken Bridge! Something like that. Might work. If it's night, maybe you can bring some beer, but if it's Sunday, it's pretty boring no matter what. There's rocks on the path, stickers too, glass. Most girls know that, so it's not a great place. Bridge back then was wooden with high old iron arcing over the top. It creaked and you could see the water through the cracks in the boards. There was barely room for two cars to pass. Graffiti decorated the flat iron. F this, F that, F him, F her. Way up on the flat angle iron, facing southward traffic way up there where someone would really have to want to get up there. And smeared thick red blood with legend. A legend's an old story. It's also an inscription, title, motto, or a caption, or an explanation. It's all of that. They would have to be shitting way up and along, hugging with both knees, not looking down. Maybe they were a curious type. Carrying the bloody arm in their teeth. They grab the iron with one hand and lean way over to smear the blood words with the arm paintbrush. There's stories about escaped lunatics. You take it in one hand and write upside down. All these people who write on bridges for cars to see are writing upside down. I'm not sure people understand that. Perhaps it'll just take time. He said the man who wrote on Broken Bridge was escaped from the state hospital on the other side of town. He would have strained with all his might and wrapped his legs tight, and he was afraid of heights. It goes to show how bad he wanted. He wrote in big, thick, bloody letters. I actually visited the state hospital and Catholic grade school tour once. Lots of people around in nurses' uniform, droopy eyes and cigarettes hanging on their lips. Industrial women, mostly what you get around here. They had a farm where the inmates could milk. The milk barn was clean, smelled like fresh hay. I remember one guy in there, he was big, with big, really dark black hair. He picked me out of the group to come over and milk the cow. I didn't want to, but I did it. The girls and everyone else giggled when I grabbed the things. He was escaped. It was nighttime, and how did he get out there? There's a lot of miles on foot through a xenophobic nosy town with nosy provincial police officers looking for him who haven't been to college or anywhere, just driving around. And a lot of these people aren't from around here. How would he know about Broken Bridge anyway? And to climb in the dark with a bloody arm in his teeth? Well, he really was into it. All by himself, a crazy, lonely man in a strange land playing his crazy game with sirens in the distance. I always wonder if they know they're crazy. Like if a kid with Down syndrome knows what he's got. I'm fat. I live on 6th Street. I'm crazy. Or don't you know? He's up high on a jagged, rusty piece of iron. He hears the pitter-patter. He stops. Eyes wide, he looks down and gets a little dizzy. He grips tighter with his knees. His heart pounds. He bites down on the arm, takes the blood, feels the bone, swallows, lets it run down his chin. Sees a coyote trotting down the middle of the bridge. Trips along kind of sideways, tongue out, looking about 2 feet in front. Passes under him without looking up. By the light of the orange full moon over the trees and the river and the recharge, the wild man swung down, sweat stinging his eyes, and he wrote with all his heart, his soul, he wrote. He felt those words, dragged them from the first memories of childhood to that very moment. Like Solzhenitsyn, Dickens, Steinbeck, Faulkner, Dostoevsky, he wrote. Behind enemy lines, like King in the Birmingham jail on used toilet paper, he wrote, "Fuck you." We headed on toward the bridge. It was dark by now. As he climbed up into his window and sat on the ledge, howling, screaming, stuff like that. "Stop," said Rick. "I got a piss." I pulled over, leaned forward for him to get out my side. AC stayed in his window, howling. "Oh, oh." Rick pissed on my back tire. I could see it in my side mirror. "Hey, what are you looking at, homo?" "Ooh." Rick quit pissing on my car. I snapped off the radio. AC jumped outside. "Ooh." The door opened. Rick pushed me up, then sat down, then he stuck his face up front. "Woo!" We all opened our eyes wide to listen to this matter-of-fact statement, kind of in-your-face, sort of. Like a tough guy standing outside the bowling alley on a Friday night, leaning against a dark blue Challenger, a cigarette in one hand, staring down all the jocks as they come out. A big white owl swooped right in front of us, turning its head, looking right in at us, its eyes wide and unblinking, probably seeing the same by the dashboard lights. Big eyes and mouths, white knuckles on the hard, shine metal. The owl swooped right, straight up about three stories of an elevator shaft to sit on the telephone pole. We all sat back and breathed. This was a low growl from the woods. We sat up and jammed our fingertips into the black, shiny Chevy metal dashboard. Something came out from the woods. You're looking, you don't know if you're really seeing something. On our right next to the river on the other side of the cut corn, a shadow, tall and straight, he seemed like a he, walked right up to the bridge. "Put on your lights," AC whispered. I'd shut him off for Rick to piss. Then he pissed on my car. Rick pulled away and disappeared into the darkness and back. I stared straight, squeezed the big wheel with my right hand and reached for the knob with my left. Rick slammed three shells. You could hear the springs. I pulled. I punched the foot button for brake. We watched it, him, climb the bridge by hands and by knees, just like in the old story. Up the side like a PE rope to the ceiling, across by two hands, scooched and grabbed with the knees, and then it was like he had just seen our lights in our car. He stood straight up, now with perfect balance. He howled. He raised his hands over his head and shook them like a gorilla. My nose kissed the steering wheel as Rick pushed out. "Phaser's on full stun," he said. I honked, and it made the guy shake and holler even more. Rick waved his hand back at me to shut up. "Let's go," said AC, even as he climbed back to sit into his window to get a better look. "No," I said, slow. I pulled the shifter toward me into first. AC jumped down, then right back up and popped the top on another, holding it toward the ditch to let the foam run out. The owl flopped and glided away. Rick stepped up into the light. With my toe, I punched the lights to dim, then back to bright. We all stared at the guy on the bridge. Like a skeet shooter, Rick put the 12 gauge to his shoulder and fired. A boom! The flash filled the night. A lightsaber. The man threw up his arms again, trying to fly on his back. He fell into the dark. The boom echoed across the black chill. I punched the brights off. We stopped breathing. Rick's running steps crunched over the gravel. I smelled powder. I shot forward. My nose hit the wheel. The horn blared. "God," said AC, grabbing my shoulder to throw me back. We sat in silence. The gunshot echoed around the world and came back. We breathed hard. We felt our hearts pound. We let them pound as much as they wanted. Well, I floored it. We skittered out. I headed straight for the bridge. "What are you doing?" Rick screamed and grabbed my shoulder. I headbutted him backward because I was past sick of that. He flew back and we heard pissing and moaning in the back seat. Apparently he was bleeding. "What are you doing?" AC screamed. I didn't have time to explain it. I couldn't see to turn around. We didn't want to be stuck in the ditch when the policeman arrived. We didn't want to be heading back toward town to welcome the arriving policemen. The boards buckled as we rolled over the bridge. AC stared into the dark down over the side of the bridge at the moon sparkling in the river. We rattled across, throwing up loose boards. I punched the lights off. We hurtled into the night like Apollo in dark space. Rick and AC had a fit. I lied, told him I could see barely by the light of the moon, told him we absolutely needed to run silent, deep as a submarine without sound, into the darkest parts of the night we could find. Down, down, down. I had an idea. I headed for Stone Road, no relation to AC. Turned left and right, and right again onto the less dark dirt road, more of a path up a hill, closer to an incline. Path went on about a mile, maybe less, on a steady rise. I stopped at the top next to the little cemetery. We thank you for joining us tonight on the New American Dream Radio Show. It's been a pleasure. This will be our last time in this time slot. We're switching to the 8 to 10 time slot next week on Studio A. So I'd just like to thank you all for being here and hope that you'll move with us. Thank you, Mike, and good night.
Good night, Chuck, and thanks to our guests, Thomas Wertman, Craig Lang, and Phil Ferruccio, also Terry Ling. To get the archives of the show from February 2011, go to the show.newamericandream.info. And as always, we apologize for mistakes and plan to make fewer mistakes next week. To contact the show, either Chuck or me or any of our guests, write to me at nwestiowa@gmail.com. And as always, we wish to acknowledge the work of South Dakota stone artisan Borglum Borglumson as he works to make over Mount Rushmore, put the real face of American history up there in stone. Lee Harvey Oswald, Sirhan Sirhan, Mark David Chapman, James Earl Ray. Follow the ongoing project at looserock.com, rollingstones.com, and jackrubyrubyrich.com. To help support the show, please purchase one of our Tom Jefferson Rolling in His Grave Handy Campfire Rotisseries for the hobo in your family, or get one of our family-sized Obamaville Tom Jefferson Rotisseries for the busy family on the move from town to town, woods to woods, made in Korea. And so, good night to my friends Chuck and Lorraine. Stay warm down there. And good night, Mrs. Calabash. Good night, Todd Beamer. Good night, Mark Bingham. Good night, Daniel Loon. Good night, Ken Lay. Good night, Timothy McVeigh. Good night, Emily Parker. Good night, Ben Wheeler. Good night, Crystal Campbell. Good night, Nancy Lanza. Good night, James Foley and Stephen Sotloff. Good night, Charlie Hebdo. Good night, Don Hochstrom. Good night, Reverend Pinckney. Good night, Muhammad Atta, Skip Wells. And good night, Barbara Olson, wherever you are.
Ground control to Major Tom. Ground control to Major Tom. Take your protein pills and put your helmet on. Ground control to Major Tom. Commencing countdown, engines on. Check ignition and may God's love be with you. This is ground control to Major Tom. You've really made the grade. And the papers want to know whose shirts you wear. Now it's time to leave the capsule if you dare. This is Major Tom to ground control. I'm stepping through the door, and I'm floating in a most peculiar way. And the stars look very different today. For here am I sitting in a tin can. Far above the world, planet Earth is blue, and there's nothing